This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 92. Welcome to Startups for Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Rob?
We have quite a few iTunes reviews. Worldwide, we have 208. In the U.S., we have 154, so we're up from something like 70 when we started our iTunes review drive. Some of the most recent ones, one from Oak Norton in late July says, I've listened to over 40 of these podcasts in the last few weeks. These guys are great. They're open about their own businesses, model holding each other accountable, and they are laser focused. I highly recommend them for anyone starting a company. Then Jeff and Jillian say, highly recommended. I'm not a software guy, but this is a great business resource for anyone looking to gain insight into the world of startups. Highly recommended. And finally, just yesterday, Greg Berry said, I first came across Startups for the Rest of Us a few months ago. I'm not sure how I didn't find it sooner. As an experienced, lifelong entrepreneur, I still get a ton of value from the show and find the advice given by Mike and Rob practical and on point. I look forward to each new episode and continue to recommend the show to entrepreneurs at all levels. Keep the greatness coming. So thanks for the reviews, guys, and really appreciate 5-star rating in iTunes, and just helps us appear in the top results when people search for startups. How about you? What's going on?
I talked last week about launching my new training site, or at least the relaunch of it, and I ended up having to do it a day late because I ran into some issues with the billing and sign-up code. So there's still an issue I have to straighten out where somebody tried to sign up, and it bombed on them on the enterprise plan of all plans, you know, the one that's $500 a month.
Yep.
So I have to do something about that. But I'll look at that, try and figure out what was wrong. I haven't found it in the logs yet, so I'm still looking through that. But otherwise, things are going well.
For the listeners, that's altiristraining.com, right?
Yep, that's the one.
So I've been wrestling with htaccess rewrite rules and WordPress. Yeah, so here's the deal, right? I have a blog. Hittail has a blog, and it currently resides, it's at hittail.com/blog. And that's great because it's good for SEO. It brings people to the site, does all the stuff. Problem is that blog is about 300 flat HTML files because it used to be in Blogger, and Blogger would export, it would FTP HTML files out. Google shut that feature down years ago. And so the last time the blog's been updated is 2009. So I've imported all those into WordPress. All the URLs have changed. Even though I had a contractor come in and help and try to make the URLs the same, it's virtually impossible to get everything working. So I said, no problem. Going to go into htaccess. For those who don't know, it's a way to have URLs basically rewritten so that they appear the same in the browser, but it actually goes out to a different page and grabs the content, and this should be no problem. But WordPress doesn't see it that way. So after, I mean, staring at it for an hour and things not redirecting, if I create the flat HTML file there, it works great. And if I use WordPress, it doesn't work. It gives me a 404 when it goes to grab it. And it turns out that WordPress, it actually looks at the address in the browser. It won't use the rewrite rules that are in the htaccess. So I'm either going to have to hack the WordPress core, it's like 2-3 lines of code to do it, but it's just one of those things you never want to do, right? Or I have to create a plugin so that I don't have to hack the core. I had someone writing blog posts and publishing them, and Google just went haywire and was like not indexing a bunch of stuff. So it's been kind of a struggle. It sucks when things don't work like you expect they should. I mean, I know htaccess rewrite rules just enough to be dangerous, and I feel like I'm the same with the underpinnings of WordPress. Obviously, I use the front-end admin for all my blogs and all our podcasts and all that kind of stuff, but when you get under the hood and you start modifying, it's not that I don't know PHP and how to do rewrite rules. What I have there should work, but it's that interaction effect, you know, of like which one's not working and why. And eventually, after searching for quite some time online, I'm so glad someone pointed out what the problem is. Because now, like knowing the problem, it actually shouldn't be that hard to fix.
I've dug into those rewrite rules before, and I got to the point where I had so many of them because I had ported my blog from Subtext over to WordPress that I think that Apache was actually starting to choke on it a little bit. And at some point, I just drew a line and said, the heck with it, and just let Google figure it out. And if people have happened to send it to the wrong one, oh well, there's not much I can do about it.
Yeah, I only have 250 rewrite rules right now, but that should be a snap.
It should be. Well, the only other thing I've got going on is all the stuff with Audit Shark, and I feel like I'm just buried under code reviews because I review all the functionality that I send out to have developed, and I've got a list of like 30 or 40 different things that I have to sit down and review, and they've been stacking up. So I've been handing out work, and I haven't had time to go back and actually review all of it. So my workload is piling up while they're, you know, continuing to get through their workload, and it's a nightmare. I got to sit down this week and really try and make a concentrated effort to get through those just because I don't want to get too far ahead to the point where they have left that code for so long and I find errors or bugs in it and they've got to go back and try to work around things because maybe they implemented something completely wrong.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a couple dangers with that. One, you get 2-3 weeks down the line and you kind of start forgetting what that code even does. You know, depending how complex it is, you can forget what you were doing. They're just not as familiar with it as if you had gotten back to them in a day or something. And then the other thing is, you're right, if you don't make design decisions quickly and see that it's something screwed up, then they just keep going with it. And 2 or 3 weeks down the line, they've now made a bunch of more decisions that may not jive with what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Start outsourcing, you get multiple people working. It is a definite amount of work just to keep up and keep everything. It's not even QA'd. It's like you said, reviewed to make sure it's in line with what you've spec'd out and to make sure that the code quality and the basic design decisions are up to snuff. And that's not a non-trivial amount of work to keep up with that.
Yeah. It's not like it's 2 or 3 weeks worth of work. It's more like 5 or 6 days. Yeah. It's just hard keeping up with it. So one of our listeners sent in a blog article that he thought that we should take a look at, and it's called 12 Rules for Building Your First Profitable Startup. And the person who sent it in is Rick. He's from, I believe, Australia. He just said, "Hey guys, loving the show, saw this article and thought the rest of your listeners might find value." He gave us the URL on it, and it's on layeredthoughts.com. But basically, it walks through somebody's thoughts on 12 rules for building your first profitable startup. And I thought we'd go through those 12 and see if there were some things that we could pick out and share with the listeners.
Very cool. So looks like the blog was written by the owner / founder of a site called SERPIQ, SERPIQ.com. It bills itself as the ultimate SEO research tool, outrank anyone with unmatched competition data. So that's kind of the basis he's coming from. So it looks like it's a bootstrapped product. It's a SaaS product, fairly low price point, that it's $29 a month, $59 a month, $149 a month.
So why don't we get into the rules that he set out? And the first rule is to sell something. And it's interesting because I don't know, is that something I've never thought of? I think that one of the first things that comes to mind that most people will try to do is selling their time and expertise as consulting services. And I don't think that that's what this particular rule is getting at. It's getting to selling a product. And I agree. I think that that's one of those mistakes that a lot of people make, is they say, oh, well, what can I sell? What would people find value in? And, you know, the natural answer to a lot of it is, oh, well, I've got this expertise in X, so let me sell my time and consulting services around X. When what you should really do is probably try to build like a knowledge website. Like I did AltiersTraining.com. You could also write an ebook. There's a lot of different ways that you could leverage your knowledge without necessarily selling your time directly for that.
Right. And I wouldn't even read it as that. I don't think he's talking about consulting versus products. I think he's saying sell something, meaning have someone pay you for something instead of building something like a social network. I think that's what he's getting at, because he kind of says it in his intro. He says, "I'm running a profitable company. I plan to use it and the experiences and capital I'm getting from it to slingshot myself into the next, probably riskier project." And so he talks about unprofitable, riskier ideas like Reddit or Facebook. And he says they're great ideas to pursue after you have money in the bank and are not risking everything on your idea. But until you reach that point, I think you should focus on ideas that, while smaller, can much more easily be made profitable. So this is kind of, I mean, this is what we're talking about, right? This is the micropreneur approach. This is what we talk about on the podcast. It's very much in line with that. And so I think that's something to keep in mind as we read through the rules, is that they're coming from that vantage point. And he said that the rules are to maximize your chance of success of your first startup, right? So it's the first one. And then after that, you can break these rules and go somewhere else. But I think with his lens in mind that he says, I do think that selling something is definitely the way to get started. Mm-hmm. All the products that I've launched that haven't sold anything, I have not been able to make much money from them. The only ones that I've ever made any kind of substantial money, even like $X hundred dollars a month, have been more AdSense websites. But everything else has been something where someone actually gave me money in exchange for X.
Yeah, and then that's actually one of the examples that he points out is specifically doing things where you're making money from ads or affiliate marketing and things like that. You're not just selling anything. You're making something off of directing someone to buy something from somebody else or, you know, those types of advertising ad views. So you're really not actually selling anything at that point. So I think that's a good one. The second one is build a product your customer can directly or indirectly use to make money.
Remember in my MicroConf talk, I talked about the four tiers of customer desire. Mm-hmm. And I talked about tier four is entertainment products, and they're really hard to market. Those are like games and social networks. And they're just, it's kind of like if you get lucky, you get on some hit list, you get popular, then yeah, it goes big, but it's totally hit-based. And 99.5% of ideas and apps built along entertainment lines are going to fail, and you're not going to be able to do much about it. And then tier three is enterprise products, and those are complicated products that have to really be sold. It's high-touch sales. Tier two is vitamin, and tier one is aspirin. And I say, are they sold on value, right? Because entertainment is not sold on value, whereas aspirin and vitamin are sold on value. And sold on value, that phrase, it means, does it make someone money or save them money? That's a critical point I feel like early entrepreneurs don't necessarily focus on enough, because we do see the big ideas of the Facebook, Reddits, LinkedIn's, that kind of thing. And without an enormous amount of funding in the bank, it is easy to make the mistake of not selling something based on value. So yes, I think this is a fundamental rule here. And again, the rule is build a product your customer can directly or indirectly use to make money. So I say it's save someone money, make the money, sold on value.
Your MicroConf talk really ties a lot into number three, which is to build a must-have product, not a disposable, nice-to-have product. And that's really, you know, as you said, that's aspirin versus vitamins. I mean, vitamins are nice to have, but aspirin is one of those must-have products.
Absolutely. An entrepreneur I'm still working with, he had a product that was a really good documentation system for developers and startups and open source projects and such. Problem is documentation is nice to have. And so what he found is that people would say, oh, this is great, but I don't have time to do it right now, but I'll get to it. I even said that. I was like, yes, I'm absolutely going to use it for a .NET invoice and could use it for Hittail, but I never put my docs in. And I was basically advising him and was not using his tool, a tool that I could have used because it was a nice to have. Now, as soon as he's now working on more of like a lead gen tool, that's a must have, right? I mean, everyone will pay for leads. Like, it's a total no-brainer. It's the same reason that something like an SEO tool or any type of marketing tool or a tool that helps you get more work, like proposal software, all that stuff is great because it's at the front end of the process and it's a must-have and it's obvious because everybody really needs more work.
One of the quotes he has in here specifically relating to this is, once your customer has started to use the product, they'll be in pain if they have to get rid of your product. And that's a perfect quote for, you know, defining what is a must-have versus nice-to-have.
A nice addition to this point is try not to add items to your customer's to-do list. If your product adds items to their to-do list, try to figure out a way around that. And that was one thing that Hittail used to do, was add items to your to-do list, because it's basically said, here are some great suggestions, now go build content. And that's where the article writing service has been successful, is that it basically made it so if you do have a little bit of money, it's $19 for an article, that we essentially give you something to do, and then we can take that pain away pretty quick, and you're going to get a benefit out of it ultimately, hopefully making ourselves into a must-have product. So rule number four is replace part of your customer's workflow with a better solution. And he basically says the easiest way to provide value to make it a must-have product is to look at your prospective customer's current business processes and identify steps or tasks of theirs that can be simplified, automated, or eliminated. What do you think about that?
So I think this is an interesting one, because if you are highly focused on a specific portion of your customer's workflow and identifying what the pains are and then trying to simplify, automate, or eliminate those things, then it seems to me like that is essentially a no-brainer. I mean, it almost falls back into rule number three, where you're building a must-have product versus a nice-to-have product. Because if you can eliminate that pain and make that stuff go away as part of their workflow process, then that tool becomes invaluable, especially if that process or that portion of their workflow is something that takes 2 days or is just something that is just so something that somebody does not want to ever have to do. So, you know, like, for example, matching up your transactions from your bank account with your checkbook. Nobody wants to do that. Nobody likes doing that. But it's one of those things that is almost a necessity in order to figure out that, you know, how much money you have and, you know, whether your bills are paid and whether people have been paying you. And so that's one of those things that, you know, there's a lot of software tools out there that will do that kind of thing. And it becomes essentially a no-brainer for somebody to buy that because it makes that portion of their workflow better. I mean, it makes it so they don't have to resort to pen and paper to do it.
Yeah, this one really comes back to make someone money, save them money, make them time, save them time. I mean, one of the ways to do that is to replace part of a customer's workflow with a better way to do it.
So rule number five is to have a no-touch sales process. So this is one of those things where if you have a no-touch sales process, I mean, you probably have a website up there and people are coming to your website and they don't have to wait for you to do anything. They can essentially just, they can be in their pajamas and, you know, at 2:30 a.m., as he points out, they can just, you know, go to your website, buy whatever it is that you have to offer and walk away. And you don't have to even be involved. And a lot of that actually has to do with automating your system from beginning to end so that you don't have to be involved in any part of the sales process. So that includes putting documentation out there, putting your marketing collateral out there, making sure that you have trials or demonstrations of, you know, how your products work so that they don't necessarily have to ask you questions. If everything's available to them and you are walking them through that sales process, then you don't have to be involved. And that's kind of the sweet spot in terms of being able to run a business, because the less you're involved in that front-end sales process, the more you can be involved in the back-end stuff that can be done on your own time as opposed to doing it on the customer's time.
Right. And I'd add something to this, that have a no-touch sales process set up, but be willing to do low and medium-touch sales. Like, that is such a benefit over if you have competition in the niche, if they're not willing to jump on the phone with a customer, to even exchange like detailed emails and answer questions. I've emailed some SaaS apps, and typically it's the lower priced ones that are trying to compete on price and don't really want to support the app. And I'll email them with questions and let's say, oh, that's in our FAQ, and they just link to the FAQ top line, right? So I have to now search through it, and that's fine, but I'm going to be much less likely to go and use their product if there's a competitor out there who's willing to engage with me and basically act like a real person. And so that's something that I've been pretty adamant about, is like, if someone emails us with a question, we don't just point them to the FAQ. We do mention, hey, this, you know, this is answered in our FAQ along with some other stuff, but here is your answer, and we will type it in. So it takes a little extra time, but it becomes then a low-touch sales process. And in addition, probably been on the phones between six and a dozen times with potential customers who either have questions they want to know about. Typically, I try not to get on the phone with a, you know, a $10 a month prospect, but sometimes I do. Yeah, having the willingness to just step up a little bit, since, you know, if your lifetime value justifies it, if you're not selling some $10 or $20 flat line product, I think having a no-touch sales process is awesome and it's very efficient, but being willing to step out of that when needed can be very profitable for you, and it can also just be a very good experience for your customers, and you can start building relationships with key customers.
So a lot of what you just said just reminds me of a recent article that Patrick McKenzie wrote that talked about SaaS applications and selling to enterprise customers. And if you are in a market where there's a lot of large players and that the potential customer that has emailed them, if, let's say there's a field of five or six different SaaS applications that a customer's evaluating, one of them goes to those really large vendors and they look at the deal size and they say, well, that's probably only a couple of $1,000s. On a yearly basis. So it's really just not worth my time. I'm going to fire off a, you know, one or two sentence reply to it. And, you know, they're just really not engaging the customer, where you have an advantage if you are small, because to you, $2,000 or $3,000 is probably a large deal. So you can spend the extra time and effort to engage those types of customers. And yeah, you probably don't want to do it all the time, but if you have all the things automated, then it allows you that flexibility to start answering some of those that to you are a much bigger deal. So rule number six is to build something that can scale independently of your staff. And I think that this builds a lot on the no-touch sales process, so that if you can build something that scales independently, it means that you don't have to do more work the more customers you have. And most software is like that. I mean, most software products, if you're running a website where you have subscribers, any sort of SaaS application typically fits this mold. Don't get me wrong, there are times when support costs will kind of creep in, and the more customers you have, the more support calls you're going to have to answer and support emails that you're going to have to answer. But, you know, in the reality is that your sales can scale much, much higher than your support costs are going to rise. So if you have a 100-to-1 or 1,000-to-1 in terms of your customers to support emails or support requests, you can have a much smaller number of people fielding those support requests than, you know, the number of customers that you have. And, you know, this is certainly the model that you want to follow. What you shouldn't do is something like Groupon, where you have to deal with a lot of different people. You have to have a lot of people involved in the process. And whenever you do one thing, it doesn't matter what it is, if there's a lot of people that have to be involved in it, it just makes your entire business so much more difficult. And this is exactly the reason why consultant businesses don't scale very well, because, you know, you're trying to keep those people busy, but if they're not busy, you're losing money. And, you know, if they are busy, it's very hard to pull them off of any given project to have them work on something else, even if it is more important.
Yeah, I think this is a no-brainer rule, right? I mean, this is why we're building software products, is to build something that scales. If you're not planning on raising that money and you really want to bootstrap and you really want to build a profitable company, then, I mean, this is a no-brainer. This is everything we espouse here. Build something that can scale independently of your staff and use software to scale that, basically. So rule number 7 is avoid products that rely on a community to exist and grow. The bottom line is don't build a product that's value is dependent on something that's out of your control. And so this is a great example of Facebook, eBay, Reddit. So Google would not be an example of that, right? Because if you build a good search engine, you don't need a bunch of people using it in order for it to have value. But anytime you have that two-sided market problem, we've had a few people write in and ask about ideas they have that deal with that. It's not that it's unsolvable. It's that it makes it a lot more complicated. So if you have experience building a community, or you know how you're going to get one side of it, like once you get one side, typically you can convince the other side to come. So if you're really good at, say, SEO, and everybody's searching for, you know, a particular thing, and you know that you can rank for that, you can build one side of that community pretty quickly and then basically do outbound marketing for the other side. You can typically charge a lot more for that outbound side if you get one side of the coin. eBay is a great example of that. Once you have a bunch of buyers there, then sellers are going to flock to it, right? And so you could even go out and individually start inviting sellers, and as long as you charged them enough, it could be worth your time doing it.
I mean, one of the things that comes to mind here is that how well that applies to things that are usage-based. So, for example, anytime your revenue depends greatly on the amount of usage that something gets, I wonder how much trouble that can get you into. So, for example, Google, don't get me wrong, I think they've got a great search engine, but they make money from people clicking on those ads. And their revenue is, at the very least, indirectly tied to the number of people who use their search engine. And what makes me wonder about that is that, let's say that people decide that, I don't know, DuckDuckGo is the next best search engine, and they start using that instead, and Google's search traffic starts to go down and maybe goes to DuckDuckGo or, you know, God forbid, Yahoo. But their search engine results, you know, if the number of searches going through their system start going down and then their revenue starts going down, I don't know if there's a lot that they can do about changing that. I mean, there's no amount of marketing that is going to fix that problem. It's not as if they can really turn that ship around very quickly.
But that's not what he's talking about here. Like Google, if they started losing users, they would have a linear decline. If they get 10 fewer eyeballs, they get X percent fewer revenue. But think of something like Friendster or MySpace. Like once people started leaving, it was an exponential decay. Just like there had been exponential growth, there's tremendous value in there being a community there. And if a community's not there, like imagine going to MySpace and having there only be 10 people on MySpace versus there being 10 million. Or Reddit is a great example, right? With zero people there, it's a worthless site. Like you can't do anything. You're not going to stick around. Google, it doesn't matter. It is linear scaling. Google's like Hittail or Audit Shark or any of those. If we started losing customers, we're going to decrease linearly. We don't need a community of people to support it. Whereas Reddit, Facebook, LinkedIn, any social network, any social news site, even any, like I said, eBay, two-sided marketplace sites like Texing is doing, the two guys are doing AnyFoo, like they have a two-sided marketplace problem.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. I guess I didn't quite follow his train of thought on that. It applies more to those communities where you do have that, you rely on that network effect. So rule number 8 is to build a specialized version of an ordinary product targeted at a niche you're acquainted with.
I know it's like an entire lesson base in the academy, and I think it's an entire chapter in my book of like why you must go niche. That's like the exact phrase.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it just seems so hard to conceptualize the ability to go after something that you're not acquainted with. And I mean, all the big businesses that are out there, I think, are taken unless you're going after angel or VC funding and you have the ability to take giant risks. I just don't think that for somebody who's aiming for a much smaller business or, you know, a smaller launching point is going to be able to find some big business that nobody's ever uncovered before. So niches are definitely the name of the game. And, you know, the easiest way to build a business is to find a niche within an existing business and just tackle that one tiny slice of it. And if you focus on it, I mean, you're going to be able to carve out kind of as much as you want while you're focused on that one niche. And you're going to be able to carve it up from whoever else is out there because you're focused on it. They're looking at the broader market saying, well, sure, we could compete there, but we do all of these other things that that company doesn't do. We don't really care about them. And I think it's just definitely a great way to go. I think that anybody can successfully take this strategy and go to market with it.
Right. There's so many benefits of going niche. One, there's less competition in niches. That means that typically the marketing is just not as good. So if you're a decent copywriter and you know just something about paid acquisition, SEO, social networking, like typically in a tight niche, there often is no one doing that. And so there are cheaper clicks to be had. Typically the products are not as mature. They don't have as many features if there's a product serving this market at all. Word of mouth is big. Like if you get into a niche like countertop installers or electricians, or, you know, they talk to each other. And so if your product really does serve that niche well, then word of mouth will take effect a lot quicker than if you have a horizontal product that's going across an audience of 10 or 20 million people. So rule number 9 is don't avoid competitors. The author of the article says competitors are a good thing. Why? A competitor with customers is market validator. So what does this mean to you? It means you don't have to spend your time and money finding out if anyone will actually buy your product. And then he actually has a whole other post called Competitors Are Awesome, You Dummy, that he links to. He says to piggyback off your competitors' efforts in finding the market and then kick their ass by building a better product. Any thoughts on this one?
I agree. I think that the market validation piece of it is probably the most important part. If you're building a product from the ground up and trying to figure out whether there's a market for it, it's a lot easier to validate that there is a market for it if there's already other products out there that people are paying for. And that's the single easiest way to do it. I can't think of a better way, to be perfectly honest. I mean, you can do a lot of market research and you can put up a landing page and try to get signups and show people what it is that you're trying to build. But at the end of the day, if you're not solving a problem, then it doesn't really matter. And if you have other people out there who are already solving the problem and are already charging people money to solve that problem, then you know that you've got a product you can probably sell to people.
I don't think you should specifically always avoid competition, but I also think that jumping into a market that has a specific competitor that does basically the exact same thing you want to do is tough, because just building a better product is not necessarily going to get you the customers. I think the more important thing is not that you can build a better product, it's that you can out-market that competitor. So if I wouldn't say don't avoid competitors, but I'd say don't avoid competitors who have crappy marketing, where you can see that they don't know how to do X, Y, and Z, you know, all the marketing approaches we talk about, where you can see that you could outmarket them on a number of levels. Really consider avoiding competitors in a niche where these guys really know what they're doing and where they're kicking ass with content marketing and where they're doing a great job on their blog and they're in touch with people on Twitter and they're just responsive and they're known and they're doing an excellent job of customer service. And they have, even if they have a crappy product, if people are using it, I don't think that just building a better product is enough. In fact, I know it's not enough. You have to be able to both do that and outmarket them. Rule number 10 is never compete solely on price. And he says that's because pricing a product as the cheapest solution simply so you can market it as the cheapest solution is a great way to go down in flames.
I couldn't agree more. One of the things that delayed my training site launch over the weekend was I actually doubled my prices, so I had to change all of the pricing plans.
Nice.
And obviously, I think that it will pay off for me on my particular site. But I think that competing on price, when you compete on price, there's only one direction to go with your price, and that's down. And I think that the race to the bottom is the race to who's going to run out of money first. I mean, I don't think that there's any good way to win when you're competing solely on price. And, you know, with software, you don't want to be the bottom of the barrel. You don't want to be selling the product that everyone looks at and says, oh, that's just a crappy thing that, you know, anybody can get, or, you know, it's real, the cheapest thing in the market. But if you can afford it, go with this other thing, because that's the premium one. You want to be positioned as a premium solution if you can. And, you know, that's not just because you get more money for it, but because you're seen as the premium solution, you're also the top of the line. And people want top of the line. They may not necessarily always be able to afford it, but it's what they want.
Yeah, when you're charging more, you can afford better support, you can afford to build more features, you can afford to pay more to acquire customers, which means you can invest more in your marketing, and you can outmarket people. And so actually, WP Engine is a great example of not competing on price, right? He's gone the opposite direction. He actually found the middle. There's a bunch of really cheap WordPress hosting, and there's super expensive WordPress hosting, and WP Engine is in the middle. They use their speed is their competitive advantage. Yeah, it's about going up market. I think, you know, the next, if I wind up doing building another product after Hittail or acquiring something, I'm going to specifically go after something that has a high price point. I see tremendous value in finding an app that provides enough value to bill at least $49 a month, and ideally $99 a month for the lowest plan. It just makes a lot of sense to me. And you can grow a business so much faster doing that, even though you will need low to medium touch sales, and you will need to have more features and have really good support. And you do a lot of things that if you're charging $9 for it that you don't need to do, but you're going to have more long-term customers, and you're just going to be able to get and keep customers a lot easier. So that's like a basic criteria of my next idea, is to kind of have a minimum price point in mind and then design the entire product around that assumption. Rule number 11 is build something that you know can exist for at least 2 years. He says most startups hit their sweet spot at about 18 months. There are exceptions, but don't pick a fleeting idea for your startup. Don't try to capitalize on something trendy. Oftentimes, the most boring niches and products are some of the most profitable. So I think that's a section of my talk. It's why boring products are more successful. I think a good example of not doing this is building a business on, well, it's something trendy, like you said, like Pinterest. We don't even know. I mean, what if you'd built a business on like MySpace and they kind of went away? We're pretty sure like Zynga stock's down to $3. If you'd built something that integrated with Zynga or that kind of made money off Zynga, that's a tough game, right? What is really the longevity of an integration with Facebook? If you're, because Zynga's like what, 5-10% of their revenue? So it brings in that much, and it's like, how long is Facebook going to allow that to happen? Same thing with building on Twitter. They've hosted some of their developers over the last year or two as they slowly clamp down their API. And although, I mean, you could kind of say it's because Twitter is shifting, right? I don't know if I'd say it's trendy, but it is like a fast-moving startup, and some people are getting kind of caught in the wake, and they built an entire startup, and now they're basically, you know, are shut down based on moves that Twitter has made.
Well, I think that all of the things that you just said, I mean, all of those kind of talk about finding something that you know can exist for at least 2 years. And all the boring things that, you know, like billing applications and software for auditing servers and things like that. I mean, any sort of training materials for products that are not going to go away, those things are going to have, I'll call them a shelf life. Anything where that business is going to stick around for the next several years and you know that it's going to, those are the types of things that you would probably want to target for your first business. Now, if you're looking to kind of ride a wave, yeah, Pinterest might be a good option, Twitter, Facebook, those kinds of things. Sure, you know, you can certainly make some money and, you know, turn a quick buck, but does that mean it's a long-term sustainable business? And the answer isn't necessarily yes or no. It's just that it's a risky proposition. And I think that that's really what he's trying to get at, is just that, you know, if you pick something that you know has a shelf life at least 2 years, then it's something that you not only have enough time to invest in it and turn it into a viable business, but you also know that fundamentally things aren't going to change so drastically that the business has no shot 18 months out.
So rounding us out, rule 12 is don't plan for exits or VC money. He says if your business plan includes the phrase get acquired or raise a big round, stop reading TechCrunch and rethink what you're doing. Focus on selling your product for a profit.
I don't know as I would say don't plan for exits. I think I said on the last episode, I mean, my main intent for the Altair's training website is to eventually probably sell it off. And, you know, I see it as a means to an end, not necessarily something that I'm going to hold on to long term. So I know what eventually is going to come out of that. But, you know, that doesn't mean that I'm planning to sell it. It doesn't mean that I'm saying, okay, well, I want to do this so that I can get it sold, or I'm going to do that so that I can get it sold quicker. That's really not the intent. I think that I'm intending to build it up into a sustainable business so that I can get a better price for it down the road. I kind of see what he's getting at, where he says, you know, focus on the business, focus on selling the product for profit. I do agree with that, but I don't think that you should preclude looking down the road and saying, is this something I want to do long term or not? Because things change. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, you could certainly change what your thoughts are on it in a year or two. I mean, maybe I start making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year from the training website, and I say, okay, well, you know, that's great. I'll hang on to it for a while longer. But I don't think that's going to happen. I'm going to build it up as a business and, you know, contribute the videos to it and just kind of hopefully put the marketing and things like that on autopilot and, you know, gather subscribers for it.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you on this one. You know, rule number 12 is don't plan for exits or VC money. That's just not a rule for me, right? It's like, I think that there's a big difference between planning for an exit and making foolish decisions, building a shoddy product, not providing support, just trying to grow fast with the hopes of selling out to Google. Like, there's responsible and irresponsible ways to plan for an exit. And I feel like with every app that I work on, I always plan for an exit, even if I don't plan to sell it. Even if I've owned the app for 7 years, I'm always planning for an exit because that makes your product more valuable. The more you're able to streamline, to automate, you know, everything from the marketing to the support to the sales to development, the more you're able to outsource and get things out of your hands, it actually makes the product more valuable to you in the short term, but it also makes it a much better acquisition target if someone were to want to buy it. It makes it much more valuable if someone makes you an offer. So I don't fully agree with this one. I mean, I do feel like you should always be planning for an exit. But when he says this, don't plan for an exit, I think he means don't plan for an exit in the way that a lot of people foolishly, you know, build a business that can't possibly sustain itself and they're losing money just because they want to build it in order to sell it to someone.
Cool. So any other thoughts on rules that should probably be added to this list, though? I mean, you know, obviously there's only 12 here, but, you know, do you have any that you can come up with off the top of your head that might be worthy of inclusion here?
Yeah, I think you have to do things that don't scale early on and then figure out how to make things scale later on. I think that's a pretty good rule. I don't know of anyone who's scaled up a business who hasn't done that. I also think that you need to track some key metrics. I don't know anyone who's built a successful business who doesn't track and focus on growing key metrics. I don't think you can just stumble through in the darkness and manage to build this great product that suddenly is magically used by everyone. I know that may be the dream of those of us who like to build products, but it's not the reality. I think another rule would be spend more time on marketing than you think you need to and spend less time on development than you think you need to, because we as developers are going to tend to lean towards making a gorgeous product and making everything perfect and making every line of code perfect, and that doesn't necessarily get people in the door.
I think the one I would add is talk to your customers.
Yeah, there you go.
There's not one thing in here about customer development. And I understand the viewpoint where this is coming from, where it's, you know, how to provide a set of rules for, you know, people who are trying to build their first business to increase their chances of having that product be successful. But there are a lot more things than just these 12 rules that go into it, and talking to customers and making sure that you have something that's profitable with regards to your time is certainly something you really need to pay a lot of attention to.
If you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email it to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to the podcast in iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.